as journalists, our primary loyalties reside with our audience.
Reporting information from the Sony hacks, ethical violation or public service? From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, we bid farewell to an American icon who harnessed pomp and smarm to produce searing cultural satire.
Anyone can read the news to you. I promise to feel the news at you.
And the demise of another media icon, Cat Fancy Magazine.
Now we have this world where the two most famous cats are Lil Bub and Grumpy Cat, who are both deformed. That would have been anathema to anybody who was a subscriber to Cat Fancy.
There's more coming up after this. WNYC in New York. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. So let's talk about this big Sony hack. A group calling itself the Guardians of Peace claims to have stolen upwards of 100 terabytes of data from Sony Pictures Entertainment, releasing everything from salaries and social security numbers to emails full of snotty studio gossip to such work materials as the latest James Bond movie script. Unnamed intelligence officials reportedly point the finger at North Korea, but North Korea attributes what it calls the righteous deed to supporters and sympathizers who share its view that Sony committed an act of terrorism when it produced the Seth Rogen comedy called The Interview.
You want to go kill Kim Jong-un?
Totally. I'd love to assassinate Kim Jong-un. It's a date.
The Interview was to be released December 25th. That date has been pushed back to never because the Guardians of Peace threatened the movie houses slated to show it in a message saying, quote, "Soon all the world will see what an awful movie Sony Pictures Entertainment has made. The world will be full of fear. And we recommend you keep yourself distant from the places at that time." First, some big cinema chains dropped the movie, and then Sony pulled it, incurring what could amount to $200 million in losses. But critics, like Matt Miller on Bloomberg News, says that loss can't be reckoned only in dollars and cents.
They've canceled The Interview, the Seth Rogen-led comedy. How do you guys feel about this?
All you need is computer skills and to know how to dial 911 to be able to get what you want from Sony. It seems such a gigantic wussy move. If North Korea can do this, then anyone can do it. Come on.
The Department of Homeland Security says there is currently no credible evidence to suggest that there's a plot against American movie theaters. On Friday, at a White House news conference, President Obama said, "I'm sympathetic to the concerns that they face. Having said all that, yes, I think they made a mistake."
We cannot have a society in which some dictator someplace can start imposing censorship here in the United States. You know, that's not who we are. That's not what America's about.
Meanwhile, a group called Fighters for a Free North Korea, which uses balloons to sail radios and DVDs across the North Korean border, reportedly plans to airlift copies of The Interview as soon as it can. They think it could have an impact.
This is the biggest interview since Frosty Nixon.
Frosty Nixon?
I mean, in 10 years, Ron Howard's going to make a movie out of this. We do this, we can interview any president on the planet. And then you can ask him the real questions. This is like eating our vegetables. Once you eat those, then you get to eat the steak. And we know Aaron wants his steak.
The Interview makes fun of American media as much as North Korea. And it's fair to say that the current international incident makes both look pretty bad.
It's stolen information that media outlets are directly profiting from. It's ill-gotten gains, I would assume. Like, they're literally reselling stolen shit. Like, it's not like they're not profiting from it. It's clickbait. It's salacious material.
Right. We didn't steal it, but we'll use it.
The more clicks they get, the more advertisers they get, the more of this shit they put out there.
That was Seth Rogen on Howard Stern's show. He's one among many in Hollywood who have condemned the media for jumping on the gossip-laden Sony leaks. Screenwriter Aaron Sorkin, whose own emails have been published, penned an op-ed for the New York Times denouncing as morally treasonous any journalist who passed along information gleaned from the hack. But is this a clear-cut ethical breach by The Times and many other mainstream news outlets? Kelly McBride is Vice President of Academic Programs at the Poynter Institute and its in-house ethicist. Kelly, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I know you're an ethicist, not a lawyer, but from a legal standpoint, this is probably okay. The Supreme Court has ruled that the press may pass along even stolen information, provided it serves the public interest. I just want to observe, though, that public interest is not measured by how interested the public is in the juicy details, is it?
Well, not normally, although some journalists would really consider a clamoring of interest to be the public interest. Most journalists wouldn't, though. Most journalists would say the knowledge of this information has to serve some sort of societal good to really call it public interest.
Then I have to ask you, what part of this salacious gossip involving movie stars and studio executives rises to the level of serving the public good?
You know, the New York Times did an article on how Sony and other studios are encouraging the attorneys general in many states to go after Google. That's a really interesting strategy when you have very powerful companies encouraging public servants to take action against other very powerful companies. I think that's interesting, and I think that is definitely in the interest of the public to know that that is happening.
Even though it was the fruits of a ransacking of a corporation's private emails. This isn't a WikiLeak. This is third parties, possibly even terrorists, just having its way with the secrets of a corporation. Aaron Sorkin certainly believes that changes the situation. The Sony lawyers believe that changes the situation. They're threatening to sue everybody and his brother, and it's hard for me not to see their point.
Their point is that you are playing into the hands of the hackers. But as journalists, we have to consider where our primary loyalties reside. And our primary loyalties reside with our audience. So if information is available that will enhance our audience's understanding of any particular issue that is of significant public interest, and certainly how powerful Google is of public interest. And whether or not the state attorneys general should be taking on Google and spending their resources, our tax dollars, taking on Google, that is definitely of interest to me and to everybody else who pays taxes. So there are almost two separate issues here. One is, how was this information obtained? And there is no doubt that it was obtained by a hack, and the hack was done by people with bad motives. But then the second issue of whether or not any of the information that has now become available is important to the public, you almost have to consider that outside of how the information is gained. Ethics are messy because you can't just say, because you're not supposed to be here in the first place, you should just back away and pretend it never happened. You can't unring a bell.
And I guess you can see that I'm a bit reactionary on this subject. I have a lot of trouble getting past the receiving stolen property element.
But the Pentagon Papers was stolen property.
With a clearly overriding public interest, because it was stolen from the government. The government was lying systematically about the Vietnam War from the beginning, and this was the smoking gun, which is a whole lot different from whether a studio executive thinks a movie star is spoiled. Let's just say that burglars break into my house, and they're frustrated that they find nothing of value. And they would be. But they locate my furry chipmunk costume that I hold quite dear for reasons best known to me. And they take it out, display it on my sidewalk. And because I'm sort of a public figure, the media come by and take pictures of it. And all of a sudden, my furry life is the subject of all sorts of gossip and speculation. if I'm the media, I don't write that story because it was ill-gotten gains.
No, see, I disagree.
And my furriness is of limited interest to anybody except for just how juicy the gossip is.
Exactly. The second point you just made is the legitimate point. The fact that you have a furry chipmunk costume is of no significant value to the public. And in fact, some of the emails that have gotten a lot of attention are really of no significant value to the public. They are merely curious and interesting. But what if they had found, when they broke into your house, that you were running an illegal gambling operation? What if they had found something that was of significant interest? I think that's the difference here.
I didn't go look for Jennifer Lawrence's stolen nude pictures, and I haven't sorted through the email traffic at Sony. I just continue to avert my glance. Is it, in fact, because I'm simply a superior human being?
It could be. Some people think voyeurism is a cardinal sin, and other people see it more as a misdemeanor. I don't know that there's any real harm that comes out of voyeurism.
Not sure, however, that it represents humanity at its best.
It does not, but humanity is rarely at its best.
Kelly, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Kelly McBride is a vice president at the Poynter Institute and the house ethicist.
Coming up, the words you choose can change the way you think.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last month, shamed by press reports, the United States Army abruptly removed outdated language from regulations governing ethnic terminology. Until November 6, 2014, it was acceptable to describe African Americans as Negroes, much as it was in civilian life, until about 40 years ago. The new policy limits the acceptable terms to Black or African American, corresponding to contemporary usage. But we are not yet in a post-racial society, and language is still freighted. A new study published by the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology, conducted by Emory University's Erica Hall, identifies a significant difference of public perception based on which of the widely acceptable terms is applied. Erica, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much.
What did you learn?
We found that white Americans perceive the term Black more negatively than African American. We found this in a criminal study, we found this in a media study, and also in an employment study.
A Black employee was deemed to have lower status than an African American employee?
Absolutely. So we did an experiment to test this. Essentially, we gave half of our white American participants an application form that read that a person was from Chicago, it had their address. And the only difference between the two application forms that we randomly assigned people to is that one had race listed as African American and the other had race listed as Black. We noticed that white Americans rated the Black applicant as having lower status, as being less educated, having a lower income, and less likely to be in a managerial position.
You analyzed newspaper articles. And you were able to identify a different tone based on which of those descriptors was used?
We searched for all articles that were in U.S. major news and business publications from the years 2000 to 2012. And what we essentially found was that those that identify Americans of African descent as a black person, the article actually has a more negative emotional tone. We created this custom dictionary that had about 300 negative emotional words, and we found more of a presence of these negative emotional words in paragraphs that referred to Americans of African descent as blacks instead of African Americans.
You say that in the criminal justice system, when a suspect is described as black, he faces a harder path.
We created a fictional crime report where the only difference that we had was that we labeled the suspect as either being an African-American suspect or a black suspect. What we found was that white Americans who evaluated the black suspect perceived him more negatively.
There was one sliver of, I guess it's good news, in your research, and that was a brief study you did on the very advent of the Trayvon Martin verdict in Florida. This was the case where George Zimmerman was charged in the shooting death of Martin, a case in which the jury would come to acquit him. But just before that acquittal, you asked some questions and found some answers that in some ways turned your other findings upside down.
With the Trayvon Martin study that we did, we evaluated a black or African-American victim. And this changes things totally around, because if that victim is perceived to be low socioeconomic status or disadvantaged or in need of help, then you're more likely to have empathy for that victim than an African-American victim, which is perceived to be higher socioeconomic status and not in need of that help. When Trayvon Martin was described as a black teenager, then people were more favorable to his case than when he was described as an African-American teenager. And furthermore, they were more likely to say that Zimmerman was guilty when Trayvon Martin was described as a black teenager than when he was described as an African-American teenager.
One of the reasons descriptives tend to mutate over the years is because a stigma becomes attached and a degree of hatefulness can become attached to what began as a relatively neutral word. The risk of coming up with new terms is that eventually the stigma will catch up to them. And frankly, I've always been skeptical of this sort of periodic shuffling of the lexicon for the purposes of racial identification. But based on what you tell me, I'm a little less skeptical now. Am I wrong to think that the stigma will always catch up to the neologism?
I don't think you're wrong to think that. I think a lot of the stigma is embodied in the time in which the term was created. So if we do progress, and I'm hoping that we do, then eventually there shouldn't be a stigma attached with the word that's created out of a more positive time.
Which requires changes less to the dictionary and more to the society.
I would agree.
One final thing, Erica. I couldn't help but notice that in this conversation and in the study itself, you don't use the term African-American or black. You've used Americans of African descent, or AADs. Is that going to be the next term of art?
I honestly think that since that term is so long, it probably will not catch on. But when I describe the research, I find that it's a lot more confusing when I choose a side.
Okay, but in the meantime, I'm going to register AAD, .com. It could eventually have some value. Erica, thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you.
Erica Hall is an assistant professor of organization and management at the Gazzetta School of Business at Emory University.
If words matter, then it naturally follows that the language matters too, especially when it comes to solving a moral dilemma. That's according to a study published in April called Your Morals Depend on Language, authored by University of Chicago psychology professor Boaz Kesar and Albert Costa, a psychologist at Barcelona's Pompeu Fabra University. When we spoke to them last spring, they told us that our decisions can change radically depending on whether we reach them in our native tongue or in a second learned language. In his research, Boaz used a classic social science hypothetical. Imagine you're standing on a footbridge. An out-of-control trolley passes underneath, hurtling toward five people who will die unless you stop the trolley by dropping a heavy weight in front of it. A very large man stands beside you, do you sacrifice him to save the other five?
Right. So we did not invent that. A lot of research shows that most people don't want to push the man.
Only about 10 or 15% of people would actually throw the man out in order to save the five others?
Exactly. That's been documented in dozens, if not more, of experiments. They viscerally cannot do it. They have a very strong reaction to the idea that they would push somebody to their death, even though they can make the calculation, you know, basically they'll save five people.
And that's when you're asking people in their native language.
Exactly.
But when you ask people in a foreign language, one that they understand but isn't their natural tongue, things change radically.
And that's exactly what we predicted. When you are thinking about it in a foreign language, it gives you a psychological, emotional distance from the problem. And then more than 40% of people then are willing to say, yes, I'll do that.
Now, Albert, while Boaz was doing this in Chicago, you were doing an almost identical study in Barcelona, totally by coincidence.
Right, right. We didn't know each other at that time. And then one day I call Boaz and I said, look, we have these weird results. And then before I finished the sentence, Boaz said, well, I know what you have. I didn't know. So what you have is that people push more the large men off the bridge in a second language, in a foreign language. I said, yes, that's right. So we joined forces and we had different samples. And it's a very strong, experimentally speaking, a very strong report.
Now, it's my understanding that a truly bilingual person would have the same kind of emotional resonance in both languages. Is that true?
Right. People that have learned the second language in the context of social relationships, these people are going to use the second language, emotionally speaking, in the same way as the first language. Okay. And indeed, in our sample in Barcelona, many of the people knew two languages, Spanish and Catalan. And when we split them according to the first language, that being Spanish or being Catalan, there were no differences in the amount of people that decided to push the large man. That is, whether you were Spanish as a first language or Spanish as a second language, but having learned that second language very early on in life, didn't make a difference.
I'm not a native English speaker. And I had the sense that I make decisions differently when I use English than Hebrew. When you use a foreign language, you have a different reaction to the words, especially emotionally laden words. You don't get the same emotional resonance. A lot of moral dilemmas, the decision involves an emotional reaction. So we figured reducing the emotional reaction by using a foreign language might lead to a different decision, a different choice.
But can you prove that? Or is it simply that they're working harder to understand the problem in the non-native language, and since they're taking extra time and don't respond reflexively, maybe that leads to more logical thinking?
In our previous study, we ran an experiment in which we asked participants to solve some logical problems that did not involve any emotional component. So you have a baseball and a baseball bat that together cause $1.10. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost?
You say 70% of the people, among whom I am, would assume that the ball costs 10 cents, but it's wrong.
People respond 10 because it's an intuitive response that comes to mind quickly, right? So it's obvious that it's 10. But it is not. Now, when we present these problems in a foreign language, people didn't respond better to those problems. Now, if it's only a matter of working harder, the fact that we didn't find the effect there, well, suggests that to some extent emotion is involved in driving these effects.
Boaz, you also looked into the effect that thinking in a foreign language has on risk-taking, and you found that people are more likely to gamble in a foreign language. Why would people take risks if they're thinking more logically? What am I missing here?
We actually looked at risks that are worth taking.
Oh, those.
You know, we take risks all the time. So how about I offer you $100 in your hand, or we flip a coin and I'll give you $10,000 if it's heads or nothing if it's tails. Would you take the risk?
The logical thing would be for me to take the 50-50 chance that I could get $10,000.
Yeah, assuming that $100 is not going to make you or break you, then yeah, you would take it. So we gave people $20 and we said, we're going to play a game now for real, 20 rounds. Each round you take a dollar and you either put it in your pocket or we flip a coin, and if it's heads, we'll give you $2.50. If it's tails, you get nothing. And you do it 20 times. If you're an economist, you would take all the bets. On average, you'll come out ahead. But people don't like to do this. People hedge their bets. So people take about 50% of these bets.
But in a foreign language, they took more.
They took about 70% of the bets. They operate with a little less fear of losing the dollar. In a way, they're less inhibited by their fears.
So, Albert, what do you think? Should we always think about difficult problems in a foreign language?
Well, sometimes to take decisions driven by emotion is important. We don't want to appear like saying the logical options are always the good ones. I mean, sometimes you have to go with your gut feeling, and that's correct. So this depends on the problem. Now, for, say, financial problems that companies may have, it would be good to have a group discuss the issues in a foreign language and the other group discuss the issues in a native language and see whether they reach the same decision. In those situations, speaking in a foreign language would help to make decisions more accurately.
Is there anything in your own life that you wish that you had considered in your second language rather than your first?
Fights. If you start having a fight with someone and you're speaking a second language and the fight is, you know, heating up, very often you switch to your first language and you say things you don't want to say. So when you fight in a second language, perhaps you take more psychological distance and you can cool down, and perhaps you can have some psychological distance that allows you not to say things that you will regret later on.
All right. So this is my life. I live in English, but my native tongue is Hebrew. And my wife and I are celebrating our 25th anniversary this August. And maybe we are able to do this partly because in our fights, it's much easier for me to say, you're right.
In English.
Because it's in English, exactly.
Boaz Kesar is a psychology professor at the University of Chicago. Albert Costa is a psychologist at Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
They are both authors of the study, Your Morals Depend on Language. Coming up, the magazine business is a cat-eat-cat world.
This is On the Media.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This week on TLDR, astrologer Susan Miller is sick, and she's not getting her horoscope set on time. Some of her loyal fans are defending her, but others are just straight up pissed off.
Like, oh, I'm sorry your mom died and you're going through a bunch of stuff, but like, get it together, Susan. And it's like, ew.
Listen to TLDR on iTunes and go to tldr.onthemedia.org for the daily blog that I write. Thanks, you guys. Happy holidays.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. What a strange time to be covering the print media when so much of it seems to be evaporating. Earlier this month, the magazine world lost another one of its giants, at least in the eyes of On the Media producer Laura Mayer, who swiftly produced this appreciation.
Do you know there's a magazine devoted entirely to cats?
Earlier this month, Cat Fancy magazine announced that it will stop publishing in early 2015. Ever since I turned 13, I've been reading Cat Fancy magazine. It's my longest-lasting media relationship.
If you're one of the 16 million Americans who share their homes with one or more of these charming, mysterious creatures, you should know about Cat Fancy.
I proudly display Cat Fancy on my coffee table so people know I'm not just a cat owner, I'm a cat fancier.
Every month, Cat Fancy devotes a special feature to a different pure breed of cat. But we never forget the popular domestic variety. You'll meet fat cats, zany cats, cats with markings you'd have to see to believe. We even delight you every month with our own Cat Fancy Centerfold.
How great is Cat Fancy? It's the only publication where you can find multiple techniques for brushing your cat's teeth. The only one with a piece on the state of snow leopards next to a profile of a perfectly proportioned Abyssinian. When I enthuse to my friends about Cat Fancy, they think I'm kidding.
Like everyone else in the media, Cat Fancy was a pair of words that I often used slightly as a joke, right?
That's Abraham Reisman, multimedia editor at New York Magazine, who pondered who killed Cat Fancy in a piece last week.
I had just been one of the many people who lightly mocked it. You'd say the National Magazine Awards are coming up, and it's a tough category for investigative journalism this year. Good luck, Cat Fancy.
Cat Fancy magazine began in 1965. It's named after the phrase, the cat fancy, a popular cat lover term in the 60s that no one really uses anymore.
It refers to a connoisseur-like approach to cat ownership and cat appreciation. You care a lot about cat shows. You care a lot about bloodlines and purebreds and who the breeders are.
I called Susan Logan, a longtime editor at Cat Fancy magazine.
Your call will be answered in the order it was received. Please stay on the line.
I have to say that I've always felt it a responsibility to be a voice for cats. This position has been a calling for me.
Logan said that, despite its name, Cat Fancy wasn't just for purebreds.
From the very, very first issue, the magazine was a voice devoted to the care, welfare, and adoration of all cats.
But it wasn't until just a few years ago, more than 40 years into Cat Fancy's run, that the magazine featured its first non-purebred on the cover. Abraham Reisman says this apparent stuffiness, earned or not, led to the magazine's eventual downfall. He says the magazine's decline is tied to a seismic shift in cat ownership that began not long after Cat Fancy's first issue.
Around 1970, the population of stray cats reached this all-time high. All of a sudden, you had an enormous amount of animals that were just being put to death every year. And around then, you had the birth of the animal rights movement. So over the course of the 70s and the 80s, you have this growing shelter population that isn't getting killed. You have a lot more cats who are mixed breeds, and eventually came growing ownership of those, you know, mutts.
And the most celebrated cats today?
They are deformed mutts. Now we have this world where the two most famous cats, at least in America, are Little Bub and Grumpy Cat, who are both deformed. And that would have been anathema to anybody who was a subscriber to Cat Fancy.
Another thing that the cat fanciers of the 1960s could not have foreseen, the internet.
In the early 2000s, you get the first known cat meme. This Japanese artist who did a lot of pixel work made this little gif of a loaf of bread that looked like a cat, making little movements with its mouth. And what began as a trickle became a flood. And by the mid-2000s, you had 4chan. 4chan used to have a thing called Catterday, where on Saturdays, people would just post pictures of cats and pictures of cats with captions. And cats, by the end of the 2000s, had become really not just the animal of choice, but kind of the object of choice for internet culture.
According to Friskies, 15% of all internet traffic is cat-related. Let me make this clear. Videos of cats jumping into or out of boxes, GIFs of cats falling into fish tanks, slideshows of cats looking depressed, cats playing the keyboard, account for 15% of all internet traffic. Cat Fancy was not made of the rough and tumble of the internet, but it rapidly gave birth to a successor that was. Over the summer, the magazine's parent company, i5 Publishing, bought two websites, Catster and Dogster. You can probably guess what those sites cover. i5's Publishing's chief sales officer, Kim Huey Stein, said, "We feel that the tone, content, and frequency of the new titles are a better fit for the contemporary pet owner and how they consume their pet-related information." Cat Fancy was quietly, and one hopes humanely, put to sleep. And its owner, i5, is filling the void by putting out print versions of Catster and Dogster. Melissa Kaufman supervises pet-related publications at i5.
They're really going to not just focus solely on the care of a cat and the care of a dog, but the lifestyle of the owner. That would be budget-type questions, cat tourism, profiling people with cat businesses, and a lot of inspiring, heartwarming stories.
There's a slideshow of cats in holiday sweaters, a feature on Taylor Swift's cat, and 10 games and gadgets for tech-savvy cat lovers. It's brilliantly search engine-optimized cat content. Case in point, New York Magazine's Reisman was talking to a Catster writer who had reached 13,000 likes on her latest post.
And it was just like a thing about cat behavior. Good Lord, 13,000 likes on a post that she'd just put up a couple days prior? I mean, you kill for that kind of traffic.
Catster satisfies that irresistible impulse some of us have to take a 5-minute internet detour, in spite of ourselves, to admire a cat that isn't even ours.
When you talk about how there was a time when being a cat lady involved having your own cats, and caring about cats involved being around physical cats, that's ancient history. If you go on the internet, you can have a wide array of cats in your life.
So what's a true cat fancier to do now that our magazine has been retired? Can I still call myself a cat fancier? Or am I just a cat lady?
What is a cat lady? It's someone who loves style, who's passionate about things. Does that make you a horrible person? No, it makes you a great person.
Melissa Kaufman.
If you look through the ages at all the highly intelligent, gifted people, creative people who've owned cats, and the cat has been their muse. I mean, that's your answer right there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what? Is Ernest Hemingway not cool? Mark Twain, call yourself a lady with cats? Wear it with pride. You should be proud of yourself.
Okay. I get it. I'm a cat lady. But I'm also a fancier. I'll miss you, Cat Fancy. For On the Media, I'm Laura Mayer.
I was thinking about how cats are natural predators, which got me thinking about how the company that published Cat Fancy is a predator too. Specifically, Bob, I was thinking about a piece that you produced for our very first show together, about a magazine that got fancied right out of existence.
Modern Ferret.
Right. Play it again, Bob.
Let's see. We have Nux and Trixie and Bosco da Gama, Balthazar, Cauliflower, Couche, and Gabrielle. They're not rodents. Their ancestors are polecats. They're in the weasel family. Basically, the animals that have that kind of wiggly kind of look.
Mary Schefferman knows just how deeply ferret owners care. From a 4-bedroom house in Lake Grove, Long Island, a home office crammed with ferret cages, ferret tunnels, ferret toys, bags of totally ferret food, and 7 slender, wriggling little vermin with names, she and her husband Eric publish Modern Ferret magazine. Since 1995, they have combined puckish wit and service journalism to explore everything from ferret heart disease to ferret-owning Playboy playmates to reviews of indispensable ferret products. Eric, the publisher, reads from the tag attached to one of them, a furry mechanical ferret.
I'm a little poop, pal. I'll tell you what I mean. Squeeze my little tummy, you'll get a jelly bean.
They poop jelly beans. Some people find it offensive. Yes.
The key is, though, that some people find anything at all to do with ferrets absolutely irresistible, which is why for 3 years they could do no wrong with Modern Ferret. They had the Ferret Lifestyle magazine niche locked up for themselves, and in 1999, right alongside The Economist and The New Yorker, Modern Ferret was judged by the influential media magazine Min to be one of the 12 best titles published in America. credit genuine devotion, an offbeat editorial sensibility, and, of course, special issues.
On the right here, we have the ferret of the century, which was the Budweiser ferret. It is a very exciting issue for us.
And now, Budweiser's replacement for Louis the Lizard...
No.
The ferret!
That's who they picked?
Real ferrets don't actually say very much, although Mary tries her hardest to loosen Cauliflower's lips.
Would you come out and make a noise? Would you think about it?
When the ferret fails to cooperate, she, of course, jumps to his defense.
They have itch breaks. They get little itches, and then they have to stop everything, and you have to just wait for them. So he's having a little itch break.
Also, it's a weasel, and it doesn't understand what you're saying.
Well, I'm motioning to him to come out, and they do understand that. And he does actually know his name, right?
Mary and Eric, blissfully happy, if only marginally profitable, lived their dream. Then began the nightmare. Fancy Publications, the Time Warner of the pet magazine business, began to publish a competing title. The juggernaut behind Dog Fancy, Cat Fancy, and Horse Illustrated hit the newsstands with ferrets.
This is typical marketing stuff from them, but they describe About Ferrets. Ferrets is a bi-monthly publication devoted to helping you care for your ferret. It is the only magazine where ferret lovers can find in-depth, accurate, current information, seek advice, and interact with other ferret owners. Having launched several years after we had been out there, it's a little tough for them to say that they're the only magazine. This is our whole life's work here, and I'd like my life's work to not be treated as if it doesn't exist.
There is, of course, a limited audience and even more limited number of advertisers in the polecat journalism category. Eric and Mary found themselves living nothing less than the bruising consequences of media concentration. Fancy Publications, according to the Sheffermans, quickly used its distribution muscle to squeeze Modern Ferret out of pet stores, costing them half of their paid circulation. And they say that Fancy's owner, Los Angeles entrepreneur Norman Ridker, has tried to intimidate them into folding.
Before they launched the Ferrets magazine, he actually took me and Mary out to dinner. And he went through this whole explanation of how he's run everyone else out of business in all the other categories that he's done. He told us stories about how he's, you know, sat across the table and, you know, bought someone's whole life's work for pennies on the dollar and watched them cry. And, you know, he really gave us the, we're going to crush you.
Ridker declined comment on the Sheffermans' charges, as did Ferrets Magazine's editorial staff. Putting aside right and wrong, however, clearly in the long run, there is no room for two sheriffs in Ferret Town. Complicating matters, Eric has a chronic digestive disorder that has sickened him for weeks at a time, and last year the Sheffermans were able to publish only two issues of Modern Ferret. Still, they pledge to press on.
I don't think we have a choice. Eric and I are very much committed to continuing with Modern Ferret, even if it comes to, you know, I have to go get a job outside the house, and we do this as a part-time endeavor. There's so many things about ferrets that if you don't care enough, and it's not part of your life, that kind of intimacy with the ferrets makes you care very much about what you're publishing.
Would it be overstating the case to say that ferrets have actually given you a purpose in life?
That would not be overstating a fact at all. I know a lot of people that they don't need that. They don't need that kind of intense purpose, but I'm one of the people who does need that, and I think it's made me a better person, if I can say that.
But that may not be enough, because self-actualization doesn't pay the printing bills. In the end, it's a dog-eat-dog world out there.
Wise,
among other species.
Enjoy it while you can, hotshots. Your days are numbered.
Louie.
I know a lot of predators, and I know several very large ferrets.
Sadly, Modern Ferret ceased publication in 2003. As for Ferrets magazine, it stopped publishing its print edition in 2008. But you can still find it online.
How will the collapse of the ruble affect Putin's power base? How will normalizing relations with Cuba affect the 2016 elections? How will the U.S. respond to the Sony hack? More important, how will Stephen Colbert use his new network perch when he takes over for David Letterman next September? Speculation abounds because on Thursday, Stephen Colbert, the fake pundit, stepped down.
Folks, if this is your first time tuning into the Colbert Report, I have some terrible news. This, in fact, is your last time tuning into the Colbert Report until... No. Folks, until 10 years from now, when they reboot it, directed by J.J. Abrams.
Here were our thoughts when we first learned he was retiring his bullhorn. When guests on his show waited in the Comedy Central green room, he would always stop in to warn them that the man they would meet on stage was an idiot, and it would be their job to educate him.
But guys like us, we don't pay attention to the polls. We know that polls are just a collection of statistics that reflect what people are thinking in reality. And reality has a well-known liberal bias.
The first riddle is how comfortable the politically diverse audience of network TV will be with a comedian so associated with the political left. Colbert, in the character of a right-wing blowhard, has used irony as a bludgeon against conservative Republicans for 9 years.
I'm sure you agree with me that it is a proud day to be an American because thanks to a minority of the U.S. Senate, we no longer have to live in fear of some maniac coming after those we love with a gun control bill.
How might such satire play at 11:30 p.m. in Kansas and Oklahoma? Well, at least one actual right-wing blowhard says it isn't meant to.
CBS has just declared war on the heartland of America. No longer is comedy going to be a covert assault on traditional American values, conservatives. Now it's just wide out in the open. It's media planting a flag here.
Let's just assume that CBS, a profit-making enterprise, isn't actually plotting to alienate exactly half of the network's late-night audience. There remains the question of who even will be hosting late night. The preening pretend ideologue Colbert won't be filling the chair. Instead, it will be occupied by the inveterate comedian Colbert, rarely glimpsed since his emergence as a star in 1997 on The Daily Show. Here's the genuine Colbert in 2007 with Tim Russert on Meet the Press.
Is it hard going in and out of character?
No. I started at Second City in Chicago, and the rule there, or the old saying was, wear your character as lightly as a cap.
Maybe he does wear his character lightly as a cap, but I take it's passing hard. Here's Colbert with Letterman in 2005, just before launching The Rapport.
And the type of thing you'll be doing on the show?
Changing the world. You know,
wow.
The people are clamoring for
the world change.
For me, I've been on The Daily Show for years, but...
How long do you think it'll take you to change the world there?
I think we have an 8-week initial commitment.
You know, I think the crowning moment of my professional career was when I got to be on his show. I was talking about The Influencing Machine, a media history/manifesto I'd made with illustrator Josh Neufeld.
It's a great book. It's kind of like a graphic novel. We've got lots of pictures in here. It's a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in it a lot.
Yes, I am.
If you're going to put yourself in a comic book, why cast yourself as an NPR host? Why not give yourself, like, heat vision?
I was so excited he liked the book, I didn't respond with the obvious rejoinder. With all the characters in the world to choose from, why in your nightly comic book did you choose this particular one to play? In retrospect, the answer's obvious. Fake pundit Stephen Colbert contained multitudes. Political pitchman, self-righteous hack, pompous patriot, sloppy sentimentalist, and of course, oblivious ignorant boob. Many said it couldn't be done, a one-note character sustaining a show night after night after night.
Now, I know some of you may not trust your gut yet, but with my help, you will. The truthiness is, anyone can read the news to you. I promise to feel the news at you.
could have imagined what a many splendored thing it could be. Not just for skewering the right, but the nation's increasingly splenetic zeitgeist that fosters the accretion of balderdash, which he confronts right at the source, and for just a moment, shames and shrivels it.
I am happy to use my celebrity to draw attention to this important, complicated issue, and I certainly hope that my star power can bump this hearing all the way up to C-SPAN 1.
Legislators sat glumly at this subcommittee hearing on, quote, protecting America's harvest.
I don't want a tomato picked by a Mexican. I want it picked by an American, then sliced by a Guatemalan and served by a Venezuelan in a spa where a Chilean gives me a Brazilian.
Hardly anyone laughed.
My great-grandfather did not travel across 4,000 miles of the Atlantic Ocean to see this country overrun by immigrants. He did it because he killed a man back in Ireland.
It was hilariously painful.
I trust that following my testimony, both sides will work together in the best interest of the American people, as you always do.
Stephen Colbert is a brilliant comedian who uses his powers for good. He seems to be a modest man, too modest perhaps, to see that by lightly shedding the cap of his creation, he's depriving us all of a national treasure. And I'm not joking.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Sarah Abdurkhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Andrew Chug, and Ethan Cheel. We had more help from Kasia Mihalovich, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Merritt Jacob.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. Please do go to our website and sign up for our newsletter. You'll get a jump on what's coming up and lots of other stuff. And while you're at it, subscribe to our cool little podcast about life online, TLDR. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.